All right, ready to be funny and entertaining and informative?
Sure, just like
Yeah, I
always.
need a lot more caffeine.
I need any.
Welcome to Paper Money, the biweekly podcast covering the business side of the game industry. From Xenor to Xenophon, 10,000 Against Persia, As Your Wish Edition to Decision Games. I'm Ben Clark.
I'm Red Kip. Wow, you did go for some interesting ones.
Hey, come on. They're X. Do you know? I mean, I automatically disqualified any game that was started with X-Men.
I'll go along with that one.
And being a proud owner of Xenor, because when I put it on eBay, no one would buy it. I figured I had to include that one. I think if you go over to Board Game Geek, you'll find Xenor listed on like people's guilty pleasures list or games they're embarrassed about or something like that. But yeah, Xenor crops up occasionally on the Geek. So that said. I was surprised I couldn't find any games that started with Xerxes.
I can understand why you wouldn't find things starting with Xerxes, but just me.
I mean, it's okay. Yes, Xerxes isn't quite as common as you might like in terms of, you know, historical gaming, but I'm working to change that now.
Well, there you have it. And generally speaking, I would expect that they would come up with terms more on, you know, either Persia, if you're lucky, or more likely they're going to talk from the Greek standpoint. We're a little Western.
Oh, well, okay. See, now you're getting technical about it. I just wanted to say Xerxes on there.
I know. You love Xerxes.
So if I didn't say this before, today is supposed to be May 14th, 2010. It's not really, actually. We're recording the show early this week because I on May 14th at 2:20 p.m., I'll be standing in Titusville, Florida, watching the last flight of the Space Shuttle Atlantis.
Yeah, pretty
last scheduled flight, I should point out.
Scheduled flight, and pretty cool because of the fact that, you know, it ends America's intentional manned space flights.
Well, the unintentional manned space flight was just a disaster.
Yeah, you know, and you know, well, they've tried some of those, and it doesn't always work out well.
Yeah, I think I saw that video on Jackass.
Yeah. And, you know, as I say, though, just an interesting moment in history. And, you know,
I firmly
currently doing my best Spock impression with the cocked eyebrow.
Oh, that works well on an audio format.
Yeah, it's a great audio, my great visuals for audio. And, you know, I have to say that I'm really A, surprised, and B, more disappointed. We seem to be diverging from gaming. Now, if there's, you know, we're into space race gamings, so we have a great link here this week.
Well, my son and I are going to play Space Hulk.
All right, there we go.
We'll tie that in. So anyways, so we're actually recording the show a little bit early. So God forbid Wizards of the Coast goes bankrupt tomorrow or Wednesday.
We'll find a way to report that.
Yeah, that's right. We'll do a special phone addendum onto the show. The good news is, by the way, we do have an interview this week. We're going to be talking with Mr. Dave Dobson of Plankton Games and the Plankton Games Journal. We'll have him on the show in a little bit. So without further ado, we do have further ado. If you've been getting the show off of iTunes, welcome, because for some reason iTunes, the Imagic Graphics feed was down, and iTunes did not pick up the new feed correctly. So we think iTunes has now picked up the new feed correctly, but somehow, if you're getting the show from iTunes, episode 25 is lost in the ether. It still hasn't come through on iTunes. So if you're getting the show from the Purple Pond, you know a guy who's getting it from iTunes. Let him know. We did a show number 25, and now we're doing a show number 26. We're working on these technical issues, trying to get them resolved. Suffice to say, a lot of it has to do with iTunes. So. And some of it has to do with Imagic Graphics, but I digress.
Surprise!
Yeah. So anyways, without further ado, having done with the earlier ados, we're going to go into the news. Brett, this one's a doozy. I read this story and my jaw dropped. Hasbro loses Stratego license. This is from thepurplepawn.com. Bet you didn't even know that Hasbro, a.k.a. Milton Bradley, doesn't own Stratego, but licenses it from Jumbo Desette. Well, after 50 years of partnership, JD is not renewing Hasbro's license to the game, which is set to expire at the end of this year. Why are they parting ways? Quote, unquote, different strategic views, end quote. I wonder if that was a pun. Strategic. Between the companies, Hasbro wants a Dora the Explorer version and JD. Oh, okay. Oh, wait, I can't read that on the air. Can we say suck it on a podcast?
I believe we can.
Okay.
I believe we haven't.
Nobody, yeah, exactly. FCC so rules. Nobody knows what different strategic views is. My thing here is that it's code word for Jumbo Desette thinks that Hasbro is making too much money and not giving them enough.
Yeah, I would say it either follows under that or that they've that Hasbro has decided to limit some level of Stratego. You know, we kind of talked about this before going on air about all the variants that have come out for things like Monopoly. You know, I believe there's a Monopoly for every possible thing. Your Monopoly down the block, you know, Monopoly everywhere. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Risk seems to get a new version of it every year or so, where Stratego may be lagging behind, and maybe they're feeling that they, you know, Stratego should see more expansions. No ideas, really.
Yeah, I don't either. I'm going to say this. I have been surprised personally at the proliferation of Stratego licensed product. There's Stratego, Star Wars Stratego, Lord of the Rings Stratego. I want to say there's at least two or three others. I'm sure there's a Transformers Stratego out there. So I thought Stratego was getting managed fairly well as a brand. So I was kind of surprised by this, particularly because the only other person you can go to on this and make as much money as you're making with Hasbro is Mattel. Well,
I was going to say it would be Mattel, but you know, maybe Mattel made them a nice offer, or maybe they have plans of expanding their lines after 50 years. Maybe they're going for the second.
They got one license, you know, for 50 years. So they're gonna add number two. They know it's gonna hit big. Keep going for the next 100.
You know, they're following some of our advice. You don't go to direct distribution with only a single title.
Well, they just wanted to test the waters with that first one. So after 50 years, they're pretty confident.
They're pretty satisfied that they found something that does well. Exactly. I'm part of the group of people that, what do you mean this isn't owned by them?
Yeah.
You know, it was kind of a shock. And, Who knows the wherewithal? I mean, but on the other hand, we've talked about some other strategies that are going on that we kind of scratch our head over at the Hasbro Wizards of the Coast then with, you know, losing the Star Wars license.
Well, speaking of scratching your head over strategies, our next news story, cue the lawsuit theme.
Lawyers, guns, and paper money.
Hoi Kiwa!
Okay, Games Workshop sues Curse. This is also from thepurplepawn.com, although it's been reported also on Board Game News. This is not a cease and desist letter. This is a full-blown lawsuit with a summons to trial. Games Workshop filed a lawsuit in Maryland District Court alleging use of protected copyright for profit. There are actually multiple causes of action, but they all revolve around this theme. The suit is over WarhammerAlliance.com, the site that Curse operates to support fans of the Warhammer Online MMO. To our knowledge, this is the first time that GW has actually filed a lawsuit against a fan site. There's been plenty of legal notices that they sent out. We covered those before. But what makes this bizarre is that Games Workshop staffers have done interviews and worked on brand compliance with the site in the past. Now, it's unclear if they've received a previous cease and desist letter, etc., but it will obviously have a chilling effect, which is probably what is desired from the legal standpoint, on other fan support sites that don't operate as nonprofits. So, Rhett, what's your take on this?
I'm a little baffled. You know, I'm not really sure what it is. I don't know if, it's to send a message to the entire GW fan community, you know, leave our stuff alone because we want to make as much money off of it as possible and don't want you interfering with our chances of doing that. Or if there's, you know, some other motive. I mean, I don't know how much money they're making off of this because, you know, as it's mentioned here, It is targeted at a profit-oriented website. You know, it may be that Workshop themselves has decided to go into this market, and they, you know, they won't take no for an answer, so to speak. So they're going after them for legal reasons.
I don't know. I mean,
I'm a little baffled.
I have to confess, and this is what baffles me. Now, other than the questionable choice of domain name, which is WarhammerAlliance.com, I think they might have been a little more subtle on that. You know, there are a zillion third-party fan sites out there. For instance, if you're a World of Warcraft player, there's Warcry.com covers that, and they work and they have a City of Heroes section. They've got a section for almost every MMO out there, and it's a third-party, I'm assuming, for-profit site. So the question is, those people aren't suing, and I'm guessing there's more money in World of Warcraft right now than there is in Warhammer Online. What's the deal? Now, we all know Games Workshop is very litigious, but really, this strikes me as maybe this is Games Workshop's way of welcoming the digital players into the analog player fold. Who, you know, the analog players know that Games Workshop has been out to screw them for years. Now they're just, you know, they're just welcoming the digital people. But no, seriously, this seems like a slap in the face of fandom. And I know they've sent out the cease and desist letters, and we always know that GW's kept a tight lid on what it considers fair use of its IP. But this surprises me a lot. This is a fan community built around your game, furthering your game. I'm confused.
Well, you know, again, I'm not really sure. You know, one of the possible motivations is they really want that address.
I mean, seriously, I mean, I really don't know. And again, I don't mean to go on and on and on about it. But you know, this is one of those things where, you know, when I talk to people who are just starting out, I say, well, don't worry about patenting your game because it's very expensive and it's hard to protect and. But do get a copyright and a trademark. But 99 times out of 100, in fact, probably 99,000 times out of 100,000 or whatever, you just don't have to worry about this. You're never going to – it's the game industry. You almost never have to pick up the phone and call a lawyer. And yet Games Workshop is swinging the hammer here.
You know, I disagree with you. It's most of the times when the lawyers are called, it's very – behind the scenes. You know, I've worked for a number of companies, and I know in the number of times we've contacted lawyers regarding, you know, violations on IP. Mm-hmm. Like I say, some are really minor where they're, you know, somebody pirating imagery or whatever for profit. Some are a little bit more severe where, you know, you're looking at a major manufacturer who's looking to knock off your product line in a new format, but they're very much after your IP, your imagery, et cetera, et cetera. So, as I say, a lot of the times there's no mention of this. It doesn't get to the news. You know, it's done behind the scenes.
Sure.
It's done.
Well, and again, maybe that's what's surprising about the Games Workshop. But Games Workshop makes Apple and Nokia look, you know, like they're afraid of a lawsuit. Anyways, if you need to get that, we can pause the show. I'm sure.
Sure,
all of our
do
listeners
so,
will
please.
Know. Let's move on from Games Workshop. Castle Ravenloft board game is coming out. Now, as you guys probably know, if you're as old as dirt like Rhett and I, Ravenloft was a Tracy and Laura Hickman module and campaign setting back from 1983, if you can remember that.
To mention it, I believe it is the most successful independent piece that was ever done, which is why Ravenloft eventually got its line, and Tracy finally got to work on something called Dragonlance along with Margaret Weiss.
Ah. So what about Forgotten Realms?
It's not independent.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Anyways, here the reason we bring this up is that it's scheduled to be a board game from Wizards of the Coast, and it is a cooperative game. Now, I'm no genius here, but this gives us the Arkham Horror line, which, if I recall, that's done okay. You know,
I believe it's kind of in the top couple hundred, I believe.
Yeah. And in terms of actual box density, it is number one with a bullet. I think that game weighs about 10 pounds. But there's, you know, we have, anyways, we've got that. We have Pandemic. Space Alert just came out. The guy who did Pandemic, I think, is it's hitting the streets this week, is Forbidden Island. Cooperative games seem to be kind of a thing.
Yeah, you know, we've seen them in the zombie market. Flying
that's right,
Frogs.
That's right. There's a couple of zombie games.
Yeah, Flying Frogs, Last Night on Earth, and those types of games. You know, which is, again, this is an expanding market along with the card one, and it's good to see. And I think Ravensloft is, you know, a great title. You know, you get to go out and fight vampires. How cool is that?
Yeah, I will say this, though. Arkham Horror has been out for a while. This might have been something that maybe WotC could have pulled the trigger on 2 years ago.
Well, you know, it is WotC, which is a division of Hasbro.
I know.
And, you know, they are capable of pivoting on something like a $100 piece.
Yeah, I was going to say, they turn on a manhole cover.
Yeah, so, not exactly quick on a lot of this stuff. They do need a lot of lead time.
So, and speaking of a lot of lead time, the Dresden Files RPG is supposed to be coming out soon. Now, Rhett, I knew this was a book series. I knew that there was a show on Sci-Fi. I didn't think this was a hot RPG license, and you're telling me basically that I've been under a rock.
I think this is a really strong RPG license. I like a lot of what they're doing right now. You know, their pre-orders, you get the PDF immediately.
That's a nice promo.
Which I believe is a beta edition. You'll get the full standard PDF when the game itself releases.
Okay, so Dresden Files RPG coming out. Brett says, good. I say, huh? But we'll see how it goes. I know they've been talking about this for a while. I think they were pimping a little bit last year at Gen Con.
Yes, they were.
But I was going to make a comment. People always wonder why we have no RPG news, and I think it's the lag time between hype and delivery. It's causing me problems. I miss these stories in between. Anyways, our sponsorship this week is our good friends at the Purple Pawn. If you're looking for game news, go over to purplepawn.com. They cover the gamut. They're good friends of ours, except David Miller, who disagrees with us about boardgames.com. Again, our sponsor this week is the Purple Pawn. And for reader mail this week, we have one reader mail, and I'd like to read. This is from Mr. Dan Glover, one of the two gifted people who recorded our Paper Money lawsuit theme. And let me read Dan's letter in its entirety. You stated in your latest podcast that Ivan and I were, quote, drunk and playing Rock Band, end quote. Sir, we were most assuredly not playing Rock Band. Good day, Dan. So, okay. So Dan was just drunk when he recorded the theme. So I apologize, Dan. I did not mean to accuse you of playing Rock Band.
Horrors.
So, Rhett, tell other readers how they can get in touch with us.
Well, you can reach us via email at papermoney@purplepawn.com, or you can Skype us at Paper Money Podcast, or you can phone us at 773-634-9377. We'd love to hear your feedback and comments, so please give us a call.
Yes, and I think this is show number 26, and I'm still referring to them as readers. I really need to work on that.
Yeah, they are readers because, as everybody knows, okay.
Yeah, I digress. Yeah, I would like to mention, though, that...
And I'm the Luddite.
Yeah, you know what it is I originally wrote reader mail in the show notes, and I've been using the same template for a year now, right? This is...
This is our year anniversary.
Yeah, this is our official one-year anniversary show. We haven't really been pimping it that way, but this is our one-year anniversary, and I'm still calling them readers. So good, go me.
Well, you know, at 27, we actually crossed the one-year barrier. So.
Yeah, maybe that's what it is. Maybe next week I'll get it done. But moving on, let's move into our interview with Mr. Dave Dobson of Plankton Games. Our interview this week is Mr. Dave Dobson. Dave, welcome to the show.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Again.
Hi, Dave. How are you today?
I'm good.
Yeah. Now, those of you listening along at home don't know this. This is our second time interviewing since I forgot to press the record button.
So. Yeah, I'm even more famous. I get interviewed twice in a day.
That's right. Only one of which the public will actually hear. But the first interview was great, folks. Oh, man, talk about the one that got away. So, well, Dave is the founder, president, and sole proprietor of Plankton Games. And he writes, he's blogging about his experience going from concept to design to publication with one of his game designs. And the blog is planktongames.com. And Dave's background, now, Dave, I'm gonna read your bio, so this might be completely made up, but I'll trust you on this. Dave wrote Snood, which is one of the top-selling shareware computer games of the late 1990s, early 2000s. He teaches full-time at Guilford College, teaching geology and computer programming, man after my own heart, and has been designing board games and card games his whole life. And finally, Dave, I think you said you designed some last year in Germany that you decided to publish, and since then has been blogging about the experience. So, Dave, again, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Yeah.
So the question that I had the first time I interviewed you, and I still want to ask that question, though, is was it in the last couple of years that you said, hey, these designs are better than anything I've designed before? Or is there did you just decide that, you know what, I want to leap off the bridge and whether the bungee's attached or not and try and break into the game industry? What was the if you've been doing this your whole life, what finally turned for you?
Well, there were a couple of things. One was that, as I'm sure you're familiar with, I had a little less to do at Snood than I had before.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
I've had less impact there. Mm-hmm. I also have kind of gotten to the point where I think some of these designs are things that people find popular. You know, I actually looked pretty hard into getting one of my designs, Galapagos, published a couple of years ago.
Big Kurt Vonnegut fan, or?
No, it was actually, it's a game where you try to help your species evolve into a better competitor. And it sounds dorky, but it's kind of fun. There are all kinds of parts like a giant.
This is the game industry. Trust me, nothing is too dorky.
Yeah. Anyway, you've got all these body parts you can add to your animal, and then you can eat these different prey species or try to eat your opponents. Anyway, I play tested that a bunch, and it seems
I like it already.
I was going to say that's top shelf for me.
I could sell this. Yeah, my 11-year-old would play it in a heartbeat.
I'd looked into printing that. I'd written around to a bunch of printing companies and parts companies, and was looking at going it alone. Just because I am a little too impatient to send out copies to actual publishers and wait forever to get a non-response. And I'd looked into that, and I was trying to do the math. And at that point, the economics were just too prohibitive. You know, I was looking at investing probably $40,000, $50,000 up front just to get the thing made, because it had a lot of parts and cards and words. Then I'd have to start selling it after making this huge initial investment. And so what changed the last couple of years, one is, I've gotten a little more time to think about this and do this. And then I also had some designs that I thought I could make more cheaply and that were innovative and fun. And so I thought I'd actually give this, you know, lifelong dream a try. And I had to kind of check the bank account and see if I was, you know, really serious about this, and of course talk to my wife and all. But I think this is the time, and I'm gonna try to give it a whirl if I can make it work.
Wow. No, there's an understanding spouse, Red.
No kidding.
He talked to her and she still said, yes, you can go ahead and look into going into the game industry. So
yeah.
If I'd actually told my wife what I was planning, I'd still be in IT.
So yeah. No, well, I have some credit built up because this new thing worked out, even though that seemed like a stupid thing at the time. So
now it's time to spend that political capital.
Yeah, that's right. I'll be broke by the end of this, but in terms of spousal points. But yeah, I've got at least one shot here.
So now, one of the things that you recently posted on your blog is Red and I had talked about the single game company coming out with, you know, just one game versus coming out with multiple games. And now for those of you who didn't hear the show where we talked about that, Rhett and I had stated that Reaver Games, which is closing up shop this, I don't know, I guess this season, this spring, one of the things that that they did right was to come out with multiple titles, and to, you know, appear as if they're, quite frankly, are a bigger company than they are, which is what most game companies do. And you had said, you know, look, the single game company, it's not quite as, you know, there are advantages to going with multiple games, but the single game company, not necessarily as bad as you might think.
Yeah, well, my take on it was that there's certainly the advantages you talked about, because everybody and his cousin can be a single game plan company. You put something together, you know, pay some money to get it printed, and you've got something that might just be crap. And if you've got a couple of games and you're serious about it, then that gives you a stature instantly. But my problem with that was that to get even a single game out there, you're looking at a huge investment. And I've been looking into that on my blog. I call it the big bet. And it's kind of like, you know, putting $15,000 or $20,000 or $30,000 down on green on a roulette wheel. You know, your odds of making it are tiny. And so the idea of making that bet twice at the same time before you've had a chance to, you know, make anything back or even see if you have a clue, which, you know, nobody knows until they actually do it. It seems like that's really not the best idea.
Well, no, I don't disagree with you, and quite frankly, there's a reason I work in printing and not necessarily in publishing games, because that is huge. And the double down analogy is absolutely perfect.
Yeah, well, and you know, my thinking also is that if you've got some patience, then you know you don't lose the chance to be a multiple game company later. And in fact, if you look at Reaver, that's kind of what he did. He had an initial run and then came out with another game shortly thereafter once it looked like it was working for him. And so I think that's a model you could follow too, because you're going to know within a year whether you actually have any hope of doing this at all. And, you know, there might be that initial boost to looking a little more serious, but if your games are, you know, good enough and you can get some distribution, then, you know, you can probably overcome that.
Well, no, one of the things that, and I will say this about coming out with a game, is that, oh, is that Rhett laughing or is that Dave laughing?
Not me.
Oh, okay. All right. So maybe Rhett's just drinking coffee. Anyways, the shortage of caffeine has caused me to make us re-record the second interview. So by all means, drink coffee during the show. No, one of the things that makes it easier is the rise of the sub-distributor. Okay, when I was doing when I was working in game distribution in the mid '90s, there was no such thing. And now, if for instance, Alliance Game Distributors, who Rhett you said had
80% of the market,
yeah. Alliance might not pick up your game directly, but they'll buy it through PSI or another sub-distributor who will pay you slightly less for the game, but you'll get your game into 80% of the game stores, or at least available to 80% of the game stores, because Alliance will buy from PSI. So it is easier to do that. Now, the downside... bless you, Chris. The downside is that there's no money in it. Because what's going to happen is PSI is going to pay you 38% or thereabouts, and whereas normally you would get the stellar amount of, say, 40%, but PSI is going to pay you even less than that so that they can make money and so that Alliance can make money as well. So there's a trade-off, right?
Yeah, and that's another place where you run into this huge initial investment problem. You know, if you're looking at making 38% or 48% or 40% of retail, and your retail price is something like, you know, for the kind of game I'm looking at might be $15-$20, you're down to 40% of that, 38% of that, you're at, you know, $5.50 or $6. Mm-hmm. And unless you get up to a print run of something like 5 or 10,000 games, you're not going to even come in less than what you'd get paid to sell it.
Yeah, the magic number, by the way, is to keep your production costs at about 15% of retail. It's damn near impossible to do on a new title.
Yeah.
You're probably looking at more like 25-30% best case, and that might not even be counting your art and production and promotion costs, right? So, but yeah, that 15%, this is one of the reasons why it drives people to China.
But, yeah.
And even then, It's difficult because, and this is something that, you know, it goes back to the double down thing. You have this huge cash outlay up front, right? You're going to have to, you have to put out a staggering amount on the table. Immediately, it's gone. And then it trickles back in over the next 6 months, year or 2 years. And that cash flow discrepancy is huge. It's very hard to overcome.
Yeah. I mean, I look at this and I see three possible outcomes. One is that, you know, I print these games up, they catch on, and, you know, I have enough made from the first game to print the second game, and you know, it all goes perfectly and I end up in great shape. The second, much more realistic case would be I print them up and then I gradually sell them out and I think, well, that was a fun adventure, and I, you know, go back to teaching, and, you know, maybe that's what happens. And then there's the nightmare, which is, you know, I drop a bunch of money and 15 years from now, I go down, open my basement storage room door, and see this looming pile of cardboard that, that I paid so much for.
I have a similar problem, only I paid retail for all of the games in my basement. Red has the same problem, I think, with unpainted miniatures.
Yes.
But yes, stuff, you, no shortage
stuff's
of...
all different, and you bought it one at a time, you know?
That's true, exactly. That's true. If you had 1,000 copies of one game in the basement, you can really only play one at a time. Now the bright side is, right, you'll never have a shortage of wedding gifts or door prizes. Every year that church raffle rolls around, you know, you're good for 6 copies.
Right.
But no, yeah. That is the fear, and it's difficult to how can I say this? Good luck to you. Seriously, that is a fear that I have never conquered. It's a reason that I'm, like I said, in printing and not in game publishing. But for a minute, tell us about your game. What is your game design? What's the we liked the Galapagos design over on this end of the line. So, what are the other designs?
Yeah, well, the Galapagos is one design that's been floating around for a while. I think I still need to work a little bit on the mechanics of that because I play tested it some with bigger groups recently, and it has a tendency to bog down with more players. So that one's maybe in the future. The one I want to do now is called Diggity, and it's a card game that's got a mining theme. And it's a mechanic that I haven't really seen anywhere like that. The cards that you play have shapes on them. You can use the shapes to build different mining tools. Mm-hmm. And then as you build the tools, you're also laying out a mine on the table, kind of tile-based Carcassonne style. Mm-hmm. And then eventually the mine will produce gold, and you can decide when to trigger the mine to produce gold, depending on how many tools you have. And then it becomes a kind of struggle to see who gets the gold and who has the best tools at that point.
So you know, Dave, we haven't signed an NDA.
Oh, God. There is this kind of nervousness among all of these people who think they've come up with the, and you can tell if they're self-delusional or not if they call it the next Monopoly. But, you know, reading all the forums
and
these things,
yeah,
there are these people who really think that that they're going to lose by sharing information about their game. And to me, it just seems like you're gonna get more feedback. You're gonna learn more by sharing what you've got and make it a better product. And since you only get one chance to do this giant, you know, the big bet, make your big print run, you want to have the product be as good as it can. And anybody who would think of stealing your idea, first off, is not going to do it as well as you have. Mm-hmm. Second off, has to make the big bet on their own and are probably going to lose. So
yeah.
You can have revenge that way. It kind of makes me tired.
No, I just, the only thing I would recommend with your game is pirates. Everybody loves pirates.
A popular theme.
Yeah, and more cowbell. Okay.
Yeah. I've got another design too that I've actually even got some art for from an artist other than me, and I stopped doing good art when I left my crayons behind in kindergarten. But that one's actually on the same theme. You've got different shapes, but it's a factory theme, and you're trying to combine these shapes into parts to fulfill orders. I've got a bunch of ideas that I've playtested pretty thoroughly, I think are cool. But I've got to get the art in place. I've got to get the rules. I'm at kind of the blind playtesting stage on a couple of these things. Mm-hmm. Firm up my gut, take a deep breath, and see if I'm willing to put my money on the table.
Now, I have one last question for you. Bless you, Chris. How did you decide which design to go with, right? You've got multiple designs. Did you pick the one that costs – now, you said Galapagos was way too expensive and this was more cost-effective. Did you choose cost-effectiveness, or did you say, you know what, other than Galapagos, this is my best design? Which one was Diggity?
Diggity is – I think it's a – I mean, it's a good design. It'll have, I think, the draw that the hobbyist gamers like, which is it's a new kind of mechanic that they won't have seen before. It's not just a retread of – you know, some other kind of thing that's been, you know, been there and done that.
Right.
It's also, it's basically three decks of cards of different sizes. And so the production costs are lower and everything becomes easier when it's smaller. You know, if you've got a smaller box, you have less storage, less shipping, all of that kind of thing. And so for me anyway, it's a good game. And I think, I can stick my toe in the water. Although, you know, with a $20,000+ initial investment,
it's a big toe, yeah.
you're kind of doing a cannonball no matter what you do. But, you know, it was a way to try this out to see if if this stuff that I've been learning I can actually apply and see if it'll work. And, you know, I have another game, Cult, where you create your own religion and steal followers from other people. And you know, that's a game that's actually been more appealing when I go to my weekly game group. More appealing to the kind of uber gamers that hang out there.
There's nothing wrong with those guys. I'm a historical war gamer. Red Place Miniatures. There's money to be made with uber niche.
Yeah. And so I was a little torn because that I think that's been really popular. If I hold up both of them, the uber gamers want to play the one with, you know, gods and cults and all of that kind of thing.
Oh, sure. Who doesn't want bloodthirsty cult games?
Right. But I thought I'd go with the one that seemed like it would have the biggest appeal, would be the most solid, and then I'll kind of see where it goes. But I have these others waiting in the wings if this actually works out.
Excellent. So, all right. Well, I think that's a wrap on our second try at this interview.
It's been a pleasure talking
Dave,
to you.
Thank you very much for doing it twice this morning. We've got to enjoy your company for an hour and a half now, I think, as we've done this twice. But,
yeah, you called back, and I thought you were joking at first. Yeah.
No, was, God, I wish I was. in fact, there's a wonderful woman. I think it's Lisa Delfindel at Berserk Games. We recorded her whole interview, or we didn't really record it, actually. That was home. We did the whole interview, and then 3 days later or actually it was like 6 hours later, excuse me. I went to mix the whole thing together to do the show, to post it the next day, and we'd lost her whole interview. It wasn't there. And I couldn't call her back because I didn't have time to re-record the interview. It was like the middle of the night. And so having lost Lisa's interview, I at least was able to salvage yours. So by redoing it, so I feel a little better about my place in the world.
It's a pleasure.
But anyways, well, Dave blogs about his experience, and it's planktongames.com, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Excellent. And by the way, not only do we like the blog because he quotes our stuff, but he also did a really neat piece about Board Game Geek ratings and their relation to chance and luck, right? Less luck equals a better rating. Was that really where, or did it peak at percentage?
No, there was actually, at least in my simplistic, dorky analysis, there was a kind of a sweet spot where if you had a little bit of luck involved, then people liked your game more. But by the time you got up to having it be almost entirely luck determined, then the ratings just plummeted.
Okay, so somewhere between chess and left, right, center, there's a sweet spot.
Yeah.
So good stuff on Dave's blog. If you get a chance, head on over there, and then hopefully, Dave, you'll get your game printed. if not through me, then through someone else, and you'll be blogging about that on the site.
Yeah. All right, excellent. And I've really appreciated you guys and your show. It's been a great source of information as I try to figure this stuff out.
See, Rhett, you know, of our six listeners, I knew one of them.
There we go. We finally got an interview with one of our six listeners.
Excellent.
So, well, I think my blog might have a similar audience there.
Well, yeah, we'll double it now. You'll be up to 12. Our six listeners are loyal. Well, five, awesome. Since you're one of them.
Right. Well, I read my blog too.
You'll get up to 11. Yeah. But anyways, Dave, great to have you on the show. Thanks for doing the interview twice, and we'll talk to you in the near future.
Okay, great. It's a pleasure.
Thanks, Dave.
Yep. Bye.
Bye.
So that was our interview with Dave Dobson of Plainton Games. And you can check out his Plainton Games Journal, if we didn't already mention that about a dozen times, planktongames.blogspot.com. Dave's a great guy. And again, check out his blog about getting his game made. And in the meantime, Rhett, what do we have to look forward to?
Donata.
Yeah, again. Okay.
Yeah.
Not a lot of upcoming stuff.
We're climbing into it. Our next show, we're actually going to have to start announcing that there will be stuff coming in a month.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true, because it's going to be right on top of the summer season. But that said,
our next show will be May 28th, and our hopeful guest will be Catalyst Games. We're not holding our breath because we don't want to turn blue.
They're moving at the speed of business.
They are moving at the speed of business.
Glacial.
There will be a new Ice Age. I believe Nemesis will show up before they finish. And
I think the new Duke Nukem title is going to be coming out.
there we have it. I wish them
the best of luck. No, they're doing everything they can over there. And but if they're not on the show, what are we talking about?
Well, we are going to be talking about RPGs. And their positioning in the market and you know, what's going on that. It's been a while since we've actually talked about RPGs.
Yes, and just in time for summer basement gaming season.
Exactly.
So,
you know, when all good gamers, you know, are fighting the sunlight and, you know, and tans and anything else that might interfere with the gaming.
That's right. If you're in danger of getting a tan, just fully open the player's guide and put it over your head while you're lying in the chair outside.
There we have it. If you're looking to work out, my suggestion is you get into the new 6th edition champions. Bulk you up in no time. That said,
on that note,
well, that's all for us this week. I'm Red Kipp.
And I'm Ben Clark.